All right, so Arvada Springs was bought and was, as far back as we know, it was settled in 1890 by Bert Ney. And, but before Bert Ney came along, the Indians had been camping there for their, from 7,000 BC on, and we have found dozens of Indian grinding stones, hundreds of arrowheads. When I was a little kid, arrowheads were everywhere. We'd pick them up and then, of course, we'd just lose them. And then at least one undisturbed campsite that we know of. And I don't tell anybody about the campsite because someday I want to do a proper archaeological dig on that. But the reason that, and so then in 1890, Bert Ney got the ranch. Now, we don't know if he was the first owner after that or not, but in 1911, my great-grandfather, George Luke Whitney, bought the ranch from Bert Ney for $1,500. And then my grandfather, George Fenton Whitney, was 11 at the time. And in the 1920s, Luke divided the ranch amongst himself and his children. And then they lived in St. Thomas, Nevada, which, those of you who've been around here know, was covered by Lake Mead in the mid-1930s. And so my grandfather was bought out and moved to Hurricane. And it was interesting, my mother was just one of those people who never got involved in other people's business, and she would never interrupt somebody else's conversation over here. And we went out to St. Thomas because a bunch of people wanted to hike down, but my mother was too old to hike down, and I'd been there, so I stayed there. We're sitting in the car visiting. It was a nice day, and some people from California pulled up and read the interpretive sign about it, and they started talking about how terrible it was that the federal government came in and took these people's property. And so my mother all of a sudden said, excuse me. And I thought, what are you doing, mother? You never interrupt. And they finally looked at her and she said, you did not live in St. Thomas. I did. The best thing that ever happened to our family was when the federal government bought them out. They had a 15-acre farm that my dad used to say couldn't raise an argument with quarrelsome wife. I think that means it wasn't very good land. And then he had an acre of sand right next to where the train station would have been had they had built a train station. And that 1 acre of sand got more than the entire farm. And so he was able to buy a 40-acre farm in Hurricane, buy a house in town that had both electricity, and then he put indoor plumbing in one of the first houses in Hurricane to have it, bought a brand new car, and had $2,000 cash left over in the depths of the Depression, 1933. So at that point, he sold his share of the ranch, because going from Hurricane to the ranch was like going to the far side of the moon at that point in time. So he sold his share to Flora Whitney, who married Alan Ney, who was Bert Ney's nephew. And you know, you get in these old Mormon towns, and it's interesting. And so, and then, so Flora Ney was my mother's aunt. And then I always get confused about the great aunt twice removed stuff. So Keith Ney was kind of a distant cousin of mine, was a first cousin to my mother. And then he died in 1997. He and a guy by the name of Cliven Bundy had a similar view of the BLM. And they actually wrote and published a book. And I have a whole case on my ranch if you wanted about how the BLM was an invention of Satan, and but that's started the whole feud. Anyway, and then when he died, his wife owned it, and then in 2017, she had two children, a daughter and a son. The son didn't want the ranch because the ranch had been nothing but work to him. So when his daughter died, I don't know, something changed in her, because she had always said she was never going to sell the ranch. And then, so she sold it to me. And it was interesting, because the ranch was appraised at $1.4 million. And then the very next line said, there is no economically viable activity that you can do on the ranch. So I called the appraiser and said, can you explain this to me? And he said, if that ranch were to go up for sale, somebody would buy it like that, build a big cabin, put a caretaker on it, put a fence around it, and that would be the last of a public access there. So Marilyn and I agreed on a price. I bought it. And so now I am the proud owner of Arvada Springs, which is the original name of the ranch. So why did the Whitneys decide to move from the metropolis of St. Thomas to the ranch? And the first thing was, St. Thomas was hot. I mean hot. St. George is 2,860 feet above sea level. Mesquite is 1,600 feet. St. Thomas was 1,200 feet above sea level. And so, you know, the lower you get, the hotter it gets. The second thing is the ranch is at 4,300 feet. The second thing was bad water. So St. Thomas was toward the end of the Muddy River, where it converged with the Virgin River. And the Muddy River is quite clear, and the Virgin River, as my grandfather used to say, is too thick to drink and too thin to plow. My dad was always intrigued by the name, but the water was very alkaline. And they had an irrigation ditch that came out of the Muddy River and then went through several corrals, and they would dip the water out of the irrigation ditch and dump it in a barrel, because they couldn't dig wells deep enough to get to the water. So they'd fill in the barrel, let all the stuff either settle out or float to the top, and then they'd drink it. My grandfather said the water was so alkaline that you were more thirsty after you drank it than before you drank it. And you know what? This watch is going to drive me crazy. I gotta quiet it down. And then my great-grandmother's health was not very good. She had had a bout of malaria. She had had 8 children. There was a lot of typhoid and diphtheria in St. Thomas. And my family always has said it's because they were drinking water that went through corral. So, and then compared to that, the ranch was an oasis. So it was cool, 4,300 feet above sea level with massive cottonwood and willow trees and two natural ponds. It could grow all sorts of fruit, apples, peaches, strawberries, and blackberries. We fight blackberries because they are such an invasive species. We have these huge fields of blackberries out there. The temperature, we have a weather station up there, is 10 to 15 degrees cooler than Mesquite. And then you add the shade of the trees and the evaporation of the water in the natural ponds makes it, as my grandmother always called it, a pregnant woman's paradise. Many of the women and children from St. Thomas, Logandale, and Overton came up and camped at the ranch during the summer. And one of the primary industries in St. Thomas was salt mining. And we've always joked, go working in the salt mines. And so the men would stay there and work. And they'd come up on the 4th of July and have a big 4th of July ceremony. They didn't have laws about fireworks back then, so my great-grandfather would always start the day with a stick of dynamite. My grandfather, George Fenton Whitney, he always went by Fenton, said the best climate in the world, high enough so the heat is not too bad, but enough south the winters are very mild. So if you look at it from a satellite view, that's the ranch. And if you notice, all of this looks like the Mojave Desert. But all around here is greenery. That's because we sit on an aquifer, according to a geologist, of the Pleistocene, I can never say that right, volcanic layer, which makes the granite volcanic, and it sits on a Navajo sandstone layer. And of course the layers aren't clear, but there are places. I went around and counted 13 natural springs on the ranch where the aquifer comes right up to the surface. And there are places we can dig 6-8 feet down and lay pipe and pick up water. So that's why it's all green there. So if you go up to the southeast corner of my ranch, southwest corner of my ranch, this is up there. This is a picture we took, and all of this here is natural. We didn't plant any of this. Some of this was planted, and then there's an orchard right here we planted. But the rest of that greenery is all natural. And it really looks like when you're up there that God took his finger and just drew a U shape. Because right here, you can see where the aquifer no longer comes to the surface. There's the Mojave Desert. I asked, we built a road based on where the property stakes were, and then I don't know why I didn't think to ask if they'd ever surveyed it. They hadn't. And so our road went 30 feet on the BLM property, so we had to move it. The BLM archaeologist for the entire Mojave Desert came out. And when we were standing in this spot, I said, so how many places are there like this on the Mojave Desert? And he said, none. And I said, well, there's, the Bartan, and there's Juanita Springs. And he said, compared to this, there's nothing. We have 700 acre feet of water that we have, that my great-grandfather filed on in 1910. So we have a lot. So There is an example. That is my son finally spent all day catching this horse and then saddled it and spent the rest of the day giving the little kids rides. He never even got to get on the horse. And then that's just a natural, on the left picture, that's just a natural part of the trees that are there. So Aravada Springs is one of the last of the old ranches. Even in the 1970s, there were three or four ranches out there. Pocoon Springs was still a privately owned ranch. In fact, he taught me how to water witch. There were other ranches out there. Really, the white indicates what's privately owned. And right there, that's Juanita Springs, or we call it the Palm Ranch sometimes. But there's really nothing else privately owned out there anymore. A lot of that is because of the extended drought we've been in over the last 40 or 50 years. The springs that kept those alive just don't put out enough water to do anything. And then there's not enough foliage really to graze cattle, you know. I mean, on the Nevada side, they banned grazing permits in 1998. You can still get them in Arizona, but I don't know how you'd ever make any money at it. It's so dry out there. So when they bought it, this cabin was on the property, and this is where they moved into. About a third of this cabin was on the property. So the front door to the right, and then in 1972 they put the front porch on, and in the 60s in the 30s they put that back lean on, but it just about collapsed by the time I bought it, so we had to tear down the back lean and put a new one on. But the other thing they did, which just astounds me every time I look at it, so this is my grandfather in the top hat with three of his sisters. But these rock walls, they built terraces so they could plant gardens and then camp on, because there was a hill. And they built four levels of terrace using nothing but a slip scraper. I don't know if any of you know what a slip scraper is, but a slip scraper looks a little bit like a wheelbarrow with the front cut out. And then you hook one or two horses onto it, and you put the reins around your neck, and you have two wood handles. And when you're going along, if you want to fill up the slip scraper, you lift up on the handles and it digs into the dirt. When it's full, you push down, slides around along the ground until you want to empty it, and then you lift that up. And if you've ever heard the term bar pit or barrow pit, which is an old term, that's because that's how they built the roads. And using a slip scraper, you didn't want to have to move the dirt very far. But they built those, and then they built a big, huge, big, thick pine box that had big, thick boards to haul these rocks out in order to make this place where they could have their orchard and their grow strawberries and fruit and other things, some of which they sold to the women and children who came up there during the summer, but others they pack into this peach can that I still have the peach can. And that peach can was found in the 1970s when Keith Ney was putting the front porch on the cabin. And I was there when Keith came up and said, "Hey, Uncle Fenton, I want to show you this." And he showed us, and so my grandfather explained how they canned. So the cans came, And then the lid had a little bead of solder, and then a hole in the middle of the lid that had a bead of solder right next to it. So they would put the peaches in the can, use a flat soldering iron that they pulled out of the fire, and put the lid on, and they'd put it in boiling water until the steam started coming out, and then they'd seal the little hole in the top, and then they'd throw it in the pond because you wanted to cool it as quickly as you could or ruin the fruit. My grandfather, who had kind of a dry sense of humor, said, "You could only do a few thousand cans a day that way." Anyway, so they did the fruit. And on the left, that's a fig tree that was planted sometime between 1915 and 1918.
And it's
still producing. And it's still producing. It's still there. However, when the does are in fawning season, you want to be a little careful walking in there because they hide their fawns in there while they go eat. And if you happen to get between a doe and a fawn, the deer are not as pleasant as they could be. And then over here you see part of our apple orchard, and you notice how they're trimmed right about here. And that trimming is cut. That is exactly how high a deer can stand on its hind legs. I didn't know deer could stand on their hind legs, but they can. And so last year, this year we haven't had a lot of deer, probably because of the storms and when there was a lot of greenery up higher. But last year, one night, we counted 147 deer on our property. And we don't allow hunting on it, because if you go out in that orchard and just pull out an apple and hold that like that, the deer will come eat out of your hands. Generations of deer have come here, and they're used to that. And then there's having fun on the pond. This is the pond, one of them, and it was a natural pond, and they tried to enlarge it and broke the clay seal. So they had to concrete it. That's my daughter's dog, who's apparently enjoying himself. And then there's a rope that ever since I was a little kid, I've been coming down here. I'm a northerner. I was raised in Cache Valley. But my mother, when she married my father, made him promise her only one thing. That's that he would bring her home to see her mother once a year. And starting in the early 1960s, when I was 3 or 4 years old, my mother's sister declared that we were going to start having a family reunion out of the ranch. And so, for the rest of my life growing up, we came to the family reunion down here at the ranch. So, let's talk about St. Thomas. St. Thomas is in the Moapa Valley where Logandale and Overton is. That's kind of the location, and they took two routes to the ranch. And right here is the sea level on the route. And so the first 13 or 14 miles isn't too bad, but that last few miles is a lot. And that's why the Whitney Pockets are where they're at, is because it's just before that big. So when they first moved out there, they would come around for the Virgin River, come up this wash, and then over here and up. And then later, the Arrowhead Highway, which was the original highway from Salt Lake City down to Los Angeles, was built, and it went through St. Thomas. And this is the bridge that's in Fisherman's Cove. Was in Fisherman's Cove and went over St. Thomas. for the 5 or 6 or 7 years that bridge was there, then they'd go across the bridge and take that upper route. This bridge burned, and it burned so hot that the steel actually twisted out of shape. And everybody I know from St. Thomas believes that somebody who wanted to move the highway over to go up over Mormon Mesa, there was a gas station owner who had a gas station up there and he wanted. And so everybody believes he burned it. But that's neither here nor there. So this is the Whitney Pockets, which if you've ever been out on Gold Butte, the Whitney Pockets are a pretty popular destination. So this big dam was actually built by the CCC in the 1930s. It never held water because the sandstone, it just never held water. The only good it ever did was provide guys with jobs, which I guess is a good thing. But if you go up over the dam and back down, then these are the pockets that my grandfather and great-grandfather built. And the 1910s, 1920s, first part of the 1930s, it was much wetter out there. My grandfather used to say that the grass would come up to the cow's belly. And there was always water in these pockets. And so when they were coming up from St. Thomas, they would always stop here, and they'd usually travel at night, they'd be asleep. But the horses would stop, and if that didn't wake them up, the horses would start whinnying, saying, I guess they were Union horses, because they knew when that. So they'd get a drink of water and feed, rest them for a few minutes for that big climb up over the mountain. So these are some of the cool places around here. That place right in the middle was what we call the ice caves. It's 3 or 4 miles. It's not actually a cave, it's just two sandstone rocks. But you can put 200 or 300 people in there. And so on the 4th of July, after they set off the dynamite, they'd go over here and have a picnic. And then those were the Indian writings called 21 Goats. That my grandfather took us to, and then this is over by the ice caves. I climbed up that when I was younger and a little more agile. I tried it a few years ago and realized I'm neither young nor agile. So exploring the ranch, you know, swinging on the rope, the slide. This is back when I was a kid, swinging on the rope. And then the wildlife on the ranch, there's a lot of wildlife, peacocks that are kind of a pest, the hawks, the deer, the foxes, the coyotes, we have it all. And then here is just some of the desert foliage there. And then this is looking out to the east. My Aunt Marilyn always said that the ranch is the only place on earth where the sun rises, where the sun sets in the east. Because it looks like the sun's setting back there, but it's not. We're actually looking east up toward Mount Trumbull and that area. And here we're also looking back toward the east. This is the Hurricane Wash, I think they call it. And there's the horses. And I put that in just because it's such a cute picture. And then, so Arvada Springs in the 21st century. I bought it having no idea what I was going to do with it. I just wanted it. And when Marilyn said, will you buy it? I said, I'll buy it. And then I had to figure out what to do with it. So we have a lot of youth groups and family reunions and people who just come up and camp. So I deal with Clark County, Nevada, which is not the most pleasant thing in the world. Got a campground, so we have tents, we're doing cabins. So that's what we're doing with the ranch. So we went back to the original name, although it was called Arvada Farms originally. I call it Arvada Springs, and it's we call it an oasis in the desert. So that is about as quick and succinct history as I could do.
Can you take some questions?
I can take questions for as long as you want.
Tell us how to get